Robert Metz, Jeff Schlemmer, join me in the studio. Good morning, gentlemen.
Morning, Tim.
Good to see both of you in today.
Thank you.
Story, the big story, I think, the relative to the kinds of programming we do in this hour of the show, would have to be the census data. And the data reveal, not reveals. Isn't that interesting? What's the difference?
What are you getting at?
I'm putting you guys on the spot here now. Why isn't the data reveals such and such?
Because data is such and such.
Data is plural.
Oh, okay.
It's the plural, it's the plural of datum. Yeah, anyway, sorry guys, I didn't mean to do that. I'm just kind of punchy today. anyway, the census data reveal the following, that there is a serious lag in the hiring of visible minorities. This is what the census tells us. That particularly within the federal government, but not not restricted to the federal government, there is a serious shortage of people of visible minorities in the federal public sector. 4.7% of the workforce as of last March were visible minorities. The Treasury Board had set a goal of 9%, and StatsCan says the national average is actually 11.2%. 11.2%. So if it's to be truly representative, we need to have 11.2% of the federal public servants, civil servants, visible minorities. We only have 4.7. In fact, last year in 1997, new hires, only 3.1% of the new hires were members of visible minority groups. Federally regulated industries such as airlines, telecommunications, it's the radio business and so on, 9.2%. Visible minorities, close to the national average. 10.4% of new employees being hired, again, close to the national average. This has been referred to, said Ruben, by Ruben Friedman, president of the National Capital Alliance on Race Relations, as a crisis in employment. And he goes further, says, the federal public service is not meeting its target. Well, my question to both of my guests this morning is, should there be such a thing as a target? The fact, the color of your face, the kink of your hair, the religion to which you adhere, whatever, all of the things that make up minority groups or identify minority groups, should any of those matter when it comes time to get a job? And Jeffrey Schlemmer, I'm going to ask you first. This fellow refers to this as a crisis in employment. Do you think it's a crisis?
Well, it sounds like we're only talking about the federal civil service for starters. If we're talking about, if we were talking about industry generally and stuff, I'd be a lot more concerned. It's very anomalous. It's hard to understand how this can be the case because I thought the government were particularly focused on this issue. But you asked whether there should be a target or not, and I'm reminded of, I can't remember the fellow's name, but I remember he was a motivational speaker from the States who had said that he who has nowhere to go goes nowhere. That you have to have a plan in life as to where you'd like to end up. So to that extent, there's nothing wrong with having a goal or a target as to where you'd like to be. But I'd be very interested in finding out why that is, and then the question is, what do you do about it?
Well, Bob, why is that, and what do you do about it?
I think the whole issue is irrelevant, Jim. I think the reason we even have a census that reveals such data is because it was meant to reveal such data. I think a government shouldn't even be legally allowed to ask anybody about their race or their color or their creed. I mean, that's what we supposedly have gotten away from every other country in the world that's practiced some form of discrimination or racism, which is a government policy. So if that's what we're doing and we're hiring people, and it's called a crisis in employment that we're not hiring enough people of certain races, well, then that's a crisis in racism, really. You know, you say that there were new hires, only 3.1% minority. Well, how many of those, out of how many applicants? The stats are really meaningless.
What about?
I mean, that 3.1% of new hires could represent 100% of all the applicants. How do we know that it doesn't? And if it doesn't,
the 3.1% of the new hire, 100% of the people that were hired, only 3.1% of them were visible minorities.
Right, but what if only 3.1% of the applicants were visible minorities?
Sorry.
Is what I'm saying.
Yes.
So that 100% of them
got hired. Yes.
So to me, those statistics mean nothing. So what are you going to do? Go out in the street and drag people into the government just because they didn't apply?
Well, what's striking to me though is that usually the government ads are the ones that say, you know, we're an equal opportunity employer and the preference may be given to the following groups. Blah 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 blah. It's the government I think of as having been the people who were most into that. So it's strange. strange to me that they would be way behind
the
average.
What if Bob's hit on something here? What if that's the people who applied? What if, for whatever reason, the visible minorities did not apply in larger numbers for government jobs? Is there still a need? You talked about you can't get anywhere unless you're going somewhere. Is there a need for a, quote, target? And they use the term target. I mean, why do we care about targets at all then?
Well, it just makes sense to me that, first of all, the reason we care is that historically there's been a huge inequity. Historically, there have been real hardship for people getting jobs. We all know that there are all kinds of professions that for years you couldn't get into if you were of a certain religion or a certain color or whatever. I've used the example of Bora Laskin in the past, who's considered by many to be the finest Chief Justice that Canada ever had at the Supreme Court of Canada. Well, when he graduated from law school, he wasn't allowed to work at the U of T because he was Jewish. You know, he just couldn't do it. So that's why this is all an issue as to whether we should arrive one day at a stage where it doesn't matter at all. Hopefully we will. And if it appears that hiring generally is around the same as the percentage of visible minorities in society, that's great. And maybe that when that happens, then they should do away with any kind of preferential hiring. I think fundamentally the question is, are people not being hired because they're not as good as other people, or are they not being hired for some other reason? Everybody agrees the best people should always be hired, I think.
I think Jeff's comparing apples and oranges. I think there's a world of difference between having a policy that excludes people because of their race or color and having a policy that sets standards and quotas and things like that based on race and color.
Is there a difference? What's the fundamental? I mean, in each case, it's unfair discrimination.
Well, in the example he just gave, he talked about a professor who wasn't allowed to teach at a university because of his faith, I guess, in that case. That's absurd. I mean, it's discriminating on grounds that one should not discriminate on, period. One way or the other, pro or con. If somebody's working for the government or for any enterprise or for any business, they should be there for one reason and one reason only, merit. Color of skin doesn't matter. What about invisible minorities? What's all this visible minority stuff? It's almost a mental disease of people having to look at people's color and identify them, not on the basis of their race, ethnic beliefs, behavior, or anything, but on the color or the pigmentation of their skin. I mean, I just find
it shouldn't
the whole...
be relevant. It shouldn't be absolutely relevant.
Well, then why do we even have such a policy, and what are we doing sitting here talking about this?
Oh, we're having
right
a boomerang now from the fact that before it was very relevant. So now it's a question of how do you balance that out, or should you try to at all? But I think we both hope to achieve the same thing, which is one day it will be absolutely irrelevant. I was delighted when my kids were growing up in daycare that it just seemed to be an absolute non-issue that they grew up Western daycare and there was kids from every color you can imagine, and it was just an absolute non-issue.
Well, that's how I grew up. I don't know anybody who ever grew up different.
The package jokes that used to go around when I was a kid, you know, it's not that long ago that these things were quite overt. And you know, the question is, how do we bounce back from that? Or do we just do nothing?
Well, let's face it, women weren't even considered persons in Canada until the 1920s, heaven's sakes. I mean, so you can't put everything into the same barrel and say, well, because we've had this history of inequity. Well, sure, the whole world has been a history of disgusting inequity. That has been our history until we discovered freedom. And freedom is the one thing that created... We were all created equal. That was the whole ethos behind freedom. And until we discovered freedom, equality was not a possibility in our society.
This is Left, Right, and Center. We've got lots of possibilities here. One of them is that you're free to join us at any time. And Jim has called us at 643-1290. He joins us now. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. When the census came around and it asked me the question, what race are you? Now, I'll ask Jeff. Jeff, what race are you?
What race? I don't know. I didn't...
Well, you're either two races. You're either... part of the human race or you're from a different planet, because there's only one race.
I guess it's a matter of semantics, but I believe there are people who have historically broken down race based on you know, sort of what continent you come from. I'm no expert on it.
Well, see,
if somebody asked me what race I was, I guess I would probably say I was white.
Well, even that's wrong. You're a member of the human race, and
okay.
I tend
well,
to
you may be an
Jim.
Expert on it. I'm not.
You're not a member of the human race?
No, I say you may be an expert. You may be an anthropologist and may know exactly what the definitions mean, but I'm not, so
yeah.
I can see
well,
that.
I see only one race, the human race, and I tend to agree with Jim on his philosophy that he doesn't believe in racism. He believes in prejudice, and I think that's the problem we have in society. You made the comment, though, that you want to get away from preferential hiring completely?
Me? Oh, sure.
You do?
Of course.
Oh, so if Jim is deaf and couldn't speak and talk, he could be a radio host?
Well, again, this is a wonderful analogy that Herman Gooden uses
statement.
For discrimination. He says that discrimination
that
means that you disagree with, you know... if you're saying that prejudice or discrimination or any of these words has to be applied holus bolus to anything, you can't have a reason, a logical reason to distinguish between one person and another. That's completely different than what we're talking about, which is saying you don't discriminate against somebody, you don't distinguish between them unless there's a darn good reason, and the color is not a good reason.
But the government does that. I mean, you made the point you want to get away from all preferential hiring, and if you use that as an absolute, it's an absurd statement, because there's no airline pilot today flying that's blind.
Well, perhaps you should not use it as an absolute, and perhaps
you
we
do.
Could all...
The government does.
Oh, well, if you seriously think that what I'm suggesting is we should hire blind airline pilots, then I guess we're just on a different wavelength.
Should you not then couch your statements with very carefully rather than saying get away from preferential hiring? Because those on the left, they like that. They like that concept of getting away from preferential hiring, and they use it in the general, but then they apply it to everything else, and it's wrong.
Well, and I guess the other thing I should make clear is that I'm saying we should get away from preferential hiring, but you should understand
why?
That people on the left generally like the idea of preferential
why?
Hiring. Because the term... Well, first of all, again, we're talking semantics. If you're saying that you should just pick a number out of a drum when you hire a brain surgeon or anything, I don't think that you can seriously suggest that I'm suggesting that or anyone else is. However, if you say that right now, for instance, with the judges in our region, we have 40 judges of whom one is a woman,
mm-hmm.
None of them are visible minorities, the rest are... white-haired old guys,
right.
that doesn't reflect our society. And that
but
people
if they're
who
the
go,
most qualified, is that their fault?
Well, and again, the problem is, historically, they've never hired the people who are the most qualified. They hired the people who are the most politically connected.
The question I asked you was, if they're the most qualified and they have pink dots on their skin, who should we hire?
We should hire the best person, and historically we've not hired the best people because they were black or because they were Jewish.
But the question
that's
I
the problem
you,
I have. Do you
Jeff,
agree with that?
Jeff,
is that fair?
You guys on the left, you know, you twist words. The question I asked you was, if the best person to hire was pink and a white man, a black man, a Chinese, and a Jew didn't make it to the top, but the best man was the one with the pink dots, that's the one we should hire.
And that's never happened in the past, and I hope it starts happening at some point in the future.
It's not, though. See, the government twists it around. See, that's the kind of hiring I believe in, that you hire the person based upon the best qualifications. And if they're short, one-armed, whatever, you
we
hire.
We agree on that.
And that's called freedom, as
we agree.
Bob would say.
We agree.
Thanks for the call today, Jim. Good to hear from you. And Robert joins us on the Cantel line. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
Jim, I'd just like to comment that this public racism that the government endorses also works in reverse. Have you been to the terminal airport lately?
No, I haven't.
Well, I'm telling you, when you go through customs, it's like you're coming into a foreign country. Every one of the people that work in the customs when you're going into your airplane, they're all Sikhs. Every one of them. And,
every one of them?
Every one of them.
Now, you're not exaggerating a little
bit,
Robert.
I didn't see a white man there, honest. And I'd like to know what's going on there, because that just seems really strange to me. I was quite shocked, actually, like, you know, at that situation.
Well, maybe it's a situation where they have a particular affinity for that kind of work or something. I don't know.
Oh, come on.
Well, I don't know. Do you know?
I don't.
Well,
that's
what's
I'd like to. I'd like to
well,
find
then
out what
it,
is going
then
on
I,
there.
Then
why are all the people in customs Sikh?
Well, when I make a suggestion, maybe they have a particular affinity, you kind of dismiss it, but you haven't got a better answer.
No, I don't. No.
Well, aren't you suggesting the government is hiring them in preferential hiring? Is that what your suggestion is?
I don't know. Like, I just want, how is it that all the people that are in Canada customs work have one singular religious background?
I find that hard to believe.
Well, I haven't been there for
yourself.
I haven't been there for a while, Robert. Last time I was in Toronto Airport was last June. So
well, I was there in 3 weeks ago, and I was there 4 weeks ago, okay, and well, it was the same situation both times I was there.
When I was there in June, I have to tell you, I did not notice that. I wouldn't say it wasn't there, but I didn't notice it at all. It's, you know, we talked to some customs people. We had a minor problem with a woman, and she wasn't a Sikh. I remember that very clearly.
Okay.
And the woman and the man who checked, and let me just think now, a woman and a man had to check us through at one point, and the man was black, and the woman was, it seems to me she was French-Canadian, if I'm not mistaken. But that's only my experience, and
well,
that was almost a year ago.
Well, I'm telling you mine, Jim. I have no reason to tell you anything other than what I experienced.
So is that necessarily a problem, though, Robert? Let's suppose that
well,
they
it's
were
not. I just wonder how it all happens. It's like there's one big, you know, it's like if it, it's there's got to be some nepotism there, you know.
Yeah, well, maybe other people have some insights into that. Thanks for the call, Robert.
You're welcome.
Good to hear from you. We have to pause for a moment or two. Robert Metz and Jeffrey Schlemmer are with us on Left, Right, and Center. We're talking about visible minorities and hiring quotas and so on. The latest census says the federal government isn't making the mark. What do you think? Minority hiring in Canada, and we're back to the phones with caller Ron. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Jim, I must tell you, I think I had to respond to your last caller who was speaking of reverse discrimination at the Toronto airport.
Yes.
Let me suggest to you that the seats that you see are not government employees. They're actually security customs employees. The reason why they're taking those jobs is because, first of all, regular Canadians are not willing to take such low-paying jobs. And secondly, most of those things are overqualified for that job.
Yes.
And they're taking it because the regular employment team isn't hiring them. So rather than him being shot, he should be shot that these overqualified people are doing such menial jobs.
Well, again, you know, you're talking generalities, too, in the same way that he was talking general. We don't know that they're overqualified. I mean...
Yes, I do, actually. I know that from personal experience because I actually work in the field, so I'm actually talking from a position of knowledge rather than that of speculation.
Okay, so this is a situation where these people have taken relatively low-paying jobs. Why the preponderance of Sikhs, for example? There are lots of other visible minorities who traditionally work in lower-paying jobs while they're trying to get established?
Good question, and the answer is actually quite simple, for the exact reason that Somalians are parking lot jockeys. It's friends bringing friends. I mean, when new immigrants come to the country,
mm-hmm.
People who run these low-paying establishments is to bring your friends on,
yeah.
Because we want jobs. So in fact, some of them are actually given bonuses to bring their friends. So it's a familiarity thing, and friends bring friends. It's a simple answer.
All righty, thank you for the call and the insight there, Ron.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Bye bye. Ernie's up next. Good morning, Ernie.
How you doing, Jimmy?
Great, thanks.
Listen to your program this morning. I think this is a program you got this morning. There's really no answers,
mm-hmm.
because we all have our own way of feeling about this. But really, to have an answer, who's got the right answer?
Well, there isn't. The government has suggested in the past that it does have the answer, though, Ernie. And the answer was that they set targets and quotas and say we are going to reach these targets. This is the answer. If we have, for example, if we've got 2% of the people of Canada are visible minorities, then we are going to have 11.2% of our federal employees will be visible minorities. So the federal government thinks they do have an answer.
Well, I don't know.
Ernie, are you saying that hiring a person on merit is not an answer?
Well, I'm not saying that at all, no. But what I'm saying is that I look at it this way.
That's my answer, by the way. I think that's the perfect answer. Hire people on merit.
Well, I think that's important. I think if a person's qualified, the best person qualified should get the job. I agree with that. I really do. But that's not always the case. But I think that what I feel that, I think, first of all, you be a Canadian. I think that's important. And Canada should be for Canadians. That's important. And I think the other thing is that if a person is able to, our young people are able to die for this country, then they should be entitled to every benefit the country has to offer.
All right. Ernie, thanks for the call.
Okay.
Bye-bye. Question for you, Robert. Let's postulate that we live in a society wherein there is prejudice and racism. Let's postulate that within that society, in spite of our best moral efforts, there are still people who do discriminate, who find themselves in positions of authority wherein they can exercise their particular prejudices. You're suggesting that if we simply say minority status is not a factor at all, and we simply, right across the board, it's not a factor, that everything will be fine. Well, you would be right, provided that everyone agreed with that tenet, but the harsh reality is that there are still lots of people in this society who do harbor certain prejudices, who are opposed to certain groups getting ahead, who have certain personal feelings about them. Your idea that if we simply ignore this altogether and just say this is not a criteria, how then do you deal with those individuals within the system who don't agree with what you've said?
Well, I don't demand that anyone agree with me, but if you're talking about a society in which racism and prejudice exists within the authority structure of that society, and I assume by that you mean government, do you?
Well, yeah, and I'm not saying the whole government is, but say you've got somebody who's in a position to control hiring of 1,000 people, and he doesn't like blacks. In this kind of system you're saying, where it's merit only, he doesn't have to exert much effort to make sure that unless he's faced with a really graphic, a situation where someone is so obviously qualified that they cannot be ignored. But in most cases, it's not that hard to say, well, it's 50-50 here. I can either take the black guy or the white guy, but the white guy, he went to school a week longer, or, you know, whatever the case may be. His tools are shinier, so I'm going to hire him. Awfully tough to battle that.
And nor should we. If it's a businessman's property,
it's not a businessman. We're talking government.
Okay, government should not discriminate on that basis.
But how do you get to that if you don't have some kind of guidelines and some kind of targets and some kind of programs? How do you stop that person from exerting his personal prejudice over the place where he works?
You fire him. Otherwise, you can't, because to do anything else, you can pass all kinds of laws and say that you can't discriminate because of a person's color. Well, then, fine. He'll say I discriminated because of merit.
So how do you fire him? On what basis?
Well, that's my point. There is no solution to that particular problem. To get back to Ernie, who said there's no answers, there's certainly no answer if the question is, how do we get a certain percentage of ethnic and minority groups into a certain field? There is no answer to that question other than forcing it.
Okay, here's part B.
And having a totalitarian state.
Okay, here's part B. Part B is one of the reasons, one of the roots of prejudice, and I'm sure that the three of us would agree here, is unfamiliarity. We should know, at least I know from personal experience, and you guys maybe have experienced it too, and many of our listeners will have experienced it, that your attitude towards a group of people can be, quite seriously modified by interaction with an individual or a group of individuals from that group. You may, for example, be uncomfortable originally in the presence of Group A until somebody from Group A moves next door and your kids start to play together and you start chatting over the fence and you discover that you've got a lot more in common than drives you apart. If you allow the perpetuation of a system whereby you keep people apart, where the guy in the government does have the ability to keep the blacks out of his department, can you not make a case that by compelling him to set his prejudices aside, you may be creating the next generation or the next generation along, because you are allowing these groups to come together, that you may be able to eliminate or diminish that prejudice? You're never going to do it if you simply say, you can't discriminate, thanks for coming out, but there's no follow-up.
Jim, I look at other countries. One of the countries I've studied very intensely is South Africa, where they've had apartheid for years. And apartheid is totally a political problem there. The business community in South Africa was willing to hire black people for the past 50 years and were not legally allowed to do so. Because they knew, number one, again, black labor was cheap there because it was plentiful. And so that there were a lot of starting jobs for people to get in, and it was a way for whites and blacks to integrate. But the government prevented it. And yet the image we have of South Africa is this racist nation where everybody hates everybody. Well, sure, that's going to happen when you have government programs that delineate who goes where, who's allowed to do what, who's allowed to go to what bar, what job, whatever.
But surely the tenets of apartheid are an awful long way from the government saying, saying that, you know, this is not appropriate. Discrimination is not appropriate.
Well, that's what's happening today in South Africa, too. In fact, South Africa has taken an incredible step recently in terms of trying to bury its past, so to speak, its racist past. And they've gone through some incredible things that I've never seen in another country. It's been on the news lately. And they're trying to bring, together old people, old rivalries, mm-hmm. and trying to bury their past behind them and start on a new footing without constantly bringing the past up. And it's a tough thing to do, to let go of that past.
Well, I hope they're successful. And, I don't have a great deal of faith, quite frankly, in the future of South Africa.
Well, to me, the more economic and individual freedom you have, the more integration of the races you'll see. The more state control and rules and regulations and quotas you'll have, I think the less you're going to see.
Okay.
And to me, it's perfectly natural for people to feel comfortable with people of their own culture, whether that's color-based or not, whether that, you know, Italians might like to hire Italians more than they want to hire Germans and vice versa. And that does go on. I don't see a problem with it.
All right, let's go back to the phones where Jim's waiting. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning.
Yes, sir.
I still agree with the first caller. There's 90% of the Toronto airport are Sikhs.
Yes?
Yes.
Okay.
And I was wondering how come they're all there.
Well, didn't you just hear our last caller explain that?
No, but it says that's not a minimum job, it's a government job.
Well, his explanation was that they were, what did he say, they were
security customs.
Security customs people, that they were working at a minimum wage or a low-paying job, and that, in fact, as he said, they probably did bring their friends when there was a job
opportunity.
Right,
that's more or less like, you got it right, their friends come in, yeah.
Yeah,
that's right, yeah, that's right.
But they still have to qualify for the job, don't they?
No, yes, they do, but it's the same point, come back, how come you have to change rules that the Mountie police can wear turbans?
Yeah.
See, I'm foreign too. I choose this country to become here.
Yes.
But I choose this country, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I like to this country and I have to obey by the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the same as the Mountie police, and everybody knows the Mountie police, now they can choose the turbans.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't agree with that.
Okay.
I mean, if they choose their country, they have to go by our rules here.
All right. Thank you for the call, Jim.
Thank you.
Good to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
We're going to pause for a moment. 643-1290, star 1290 on the Cantel. We're talking about this revelation, if we can use that term, in the census, that federal employees are visible minorities are significantly underrepresented in federal
jobs.
Thank you, sir. We'll be back. My guests in the studio today, as they are every Wednesday from 11 to 12, Jeff Schlemmer and Robert Metz, representing respectively the left and the right, more or less, of the political spectrum on the issues of the day. And we talk about those issues. Today we're talking about visible minorities and their role in the federal government in terms of how many jobs do they have vis-a-vis how many of them are there. And Al's our next caller. Good morning, Al.
Yes, good morning.
Yes, sir.
That has been nothing new on the having Sikhs at the airports and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
About 3 years ago, I was to BC and back, and I got it down in BC, and I got it here in Toronto.
So is there any kind of problem with that? I mean, do you care?
Well, to me, it made me feel a little strange because I was in Canada, which is, I was born and lived here,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm getting machines run up and down me from Sikhs, which at the time, it made me feel a little bit, what the hell gives here?
Well, they're Canadians too, I would assume. Most of them are Canadian citizens.
Well, maybe not yet. Some could, some couldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing too, they have another machine there, the one that they run up and down your clothes at
yeah.
the time.
Yeah.
Oh, I just walked by that. They didn't even try that.
Mm.
They put my baggage on, but that's it. And all they could do was talk in Indian. You didn't know what the hell they were talking about.
Maybe they thought you were particularly trustworthy, so they didn't have to give you the once-over.
Bullshit. Come on now.
You don't think so?
No.
All right. Thanks for the call, Al.
Okay, we're going to get it in all the airports.
And Gary's up. Hi, Gary.
Good morning, Jim.
Yes, sir.
A question for you and the guys. This whole aspect of visible minorities, does anybody know what percentage of the Canadian population is visible minorities? I sure hope they're not including women in that.
11.2.
Yep. Oh, okay, and that consists of what groups? There's
well,
blacks and
anybody who's visibly different from the quote white majority white population.
Jim properly upbraided me at the start of the show before we started pointing out women are 53% of the population, the majority.
Yeah, women are not a minority by any standard.
Well, yes, I was aware of that, but yeah, I saw a blip on the news last night where blacks are something like 2% and Asians I thought were. Somewhere around 2%.
I don't have the breakdowns. What I just have the 11.2, and that's across the board. So.
Oh well, what I understood was that there's only about 6%. That's where my quarrel was coming in. So yes, your stats are likely better than my blip on the news.
Well, now let me just double check here. Federal public sector, 4.7% of the workforce last March visible minorities. Level falling far short of the Treasury Board's goal of 9. Even farther behind the 11.2% level that StatsCan figures indicate is the national average. Now, wait a minute. That does not necessarily mean it's the national average of Canadians. It might be the average in the workforce, might it not? Guys, how would you interpret
that's
that?
That's what I would think.
That's what it sounds like.
Oh, okay. Well, let me see now. Do we have other figures here that tell us more about that? Mm-hmm. No, we don't, but we'll find them for you.
Okay.
We'll find them for you. Thanks, Gary.
Good enough.
Stay with us.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Guys, in terms of the, and Gary mentioned about women, and Jeff jokingly mentioned about women before we started, though. Is that part and parcel, Jeff, to your mind, of the same challenge? Is equity between the sexes in the workplace?
Oh, yeah. There are still big problems there, and in particular industries, I guess. It depends where you look, but I was at a dinner on Saturday night, and Maureen Kempston Dark was one of the speakers, who's the president of General Motors. Yeah. And I can't remember the name of the woman who's the president of Ford, but we have presidents of both of those companies right now are women, which is extremely unusual. If you look at any of those senior management positions, if you look at senior professions, women are still strongly underrepresented. Now, one of the things we constantly debate this in the legal profession, why are there so few women partners? Because there are extremely few women partners, and they talk about the fact that they bail out for a few years to go have kids, and then it's like, well, whose fault is that? And those who say, you know, they can't be senior partners and say, well, if you choose to have a kid, then you're not going to be a senior partner. That's just the way it is. The bleeding hearts like me say, yeah, but somebody's got to have the kids, and there's no reason why it shouldn't be successful people who are having kids, and that we collectively benefit from that and should all basically cut them some slack for the fact that they have to be the ones having kids. But yeah, there's still a huge problem, and judges are a good example where there's still very few women judges, for instance. And I can understand if you're a representative of a group that are substantially underrepresented, when you go before a judge, you know, you may think, I wish there was somebody here who looked more like I did.
Now, Jeff, you've mentioned a couple times now, you know, speaking with respect to judges, that, you know, they're all white, old, gray-haired men, except for the odd person, and that doesn't reflect our society. That bothers me when you say that doesn't reflect our society. Is color what you mean? Because to me, what a judge should be reflecting is the ideology and proper law and principle and things like that. And
well, that's a whole other area, and that's a big problem too. And that is that they're inevitably very wealthy. And the question is, do they know what it's like living on the street? Do they know what it's like to be getting by on $30,000 a year, for instance? How long has it been since they have? It is a tough one. And you're right. On the other hand,
You're saying that our judges should be poor people who are barely making it on the street, so that they can empathize with people in the courts?
There's a lot of debate in the legal community about whether they should. We have to find whether there should be a way to make them more representative, like with politicians, for instance.
So maybe they shouldn't even go. They shouldn't even go to law school, because if.
But you know, again, I don't think I've ever suggested that. I've said to you, we should hire the best people, the ones who are going to do the best job.
Isn't there an argument to be made, though, that in some kinds of adjudication, that an in-depth, like a law degree, may not necessarily be required? Hasn't there been some discussion of that? Certainly not cases that turn on points of law. Obviously, that's not the case. But some domestic disputes and things like that where what you need is common sense rather than an intricate knowledge of the law. Now, it would seem to me if we opened that area up more, you're not likely to get more a wider diversity of people who could fit that bill.
Well, that's right. And the fundamental premise that I think you and I agree on is we want the best decision maker. We want the person who will come to the right answer. And the question is, does a person who's gone off and sequestered themselves in a law school and learned a lot about cases and who lives a privileged life, they make $170,000 a year, are they always going to make the best decision? Will they come to the right answer? And part of the problem is we all bring baggage to every decision we make based on what we know, you know, what our experience of reality is. And the suggestion is that there are a lot of people out there who lead such different lives that judges just can't relate to them. You know, we can't get to first base. And I can tell you, in the context of test cases we've done around poverty issues, judges have no idea what it's like to be a poor person. And it's hard for them to understand some of the realities for some of these
What would be a poverty issue in a courtroom? I don't understand what you mean by a poverty issue in a courtroom.
Well, for instance, right now there are all kinds of women out there who have who are unable to get legal help, unable to get legal aid, and have husbands who are doing all kinds of nasty things to them as far as taking kids to other jurisdictions, as far as not paying child support, as far as doing all kinds of things. The women can't get any help with that. In a lot of times they run into financial troubles because they can't pay bills that they should be able to pay if the deadbeat dad was paying his part of the child support. They run into problems with creditors. They run into situations where, for instance, they may be on the run. They may be giving false information to different people because they're on the run.
At the same time, there are a number of men out there who are making their child support payments, whose wives are picking up and moving, leaving jurisdictions and doing all. Just in the.
Oh, I know. I'm just giving an example.
I just want to be fair here, gender-wise.
No,
okay.
Listen.
Well, it goes both ways. Sure.
But anyway, my point is that it's sometimes hard for judges to understand what life on the run is like, because most of them have never done it.
See, to me, that doesn't seem to be a quote poverty issue. That seems to be an issue of responsibility and who should assume it or who it should be assigned to. I don't see that as a quote poverty issue, which is the whole issue of inequity.
and you having to deal with
poverty here is the result rather than the cause.
Basically, yeah.
But I'm just saying, if you want somebody to make a decision about somebody who's living that life, some people would suggest you need to have somebody who has some experience with that life. If you take somebody who has no idea what it's like, for instance, the king or the queen. Does the queen know what life is like for you today? If you ask the queen to make decisions about your life, does she have any idea what your life is like?
Nobody but I would know that, and that's why I don't think anyone but I should have any jurisdiction over my life.
And again, this is all, this is bandied around. It's not that there's an obvious answer, but some people would suggest that people who have totally different lives may not be the best people to make decisions about your life.
Okay, I want to come back to where we started here, and I also want to clarify 11.2 is the national percentage of people who classify themselves as visible. People who are not classified as white or aboriginal, 11.2%. So that figure was correct, just to get it out there.
The next question is, what do we do about it?
Well, do we do anything? And Jeff, let me ask you, as you've noted earlier in the program, the federal government has been pretty aggressive in terms of reaching out to visible minorities. They've enabled, shall we say, people to perhaps get ahead. If it was a 50-50 saw-off, and it was a question between the visible minority and the non-visible minority person, they've openly and admittedly taken the visible minority. In spite of doing that, they're still at less than half of the national average. Does that tell us that maybe this is a misguided program? I mean, if even given all this assistance, the people are still not, the visible minorities are still not seeking these jobs, maybe there's no need to do it in the first place.
Except that we've got, you said for federal regulated industries, they're at 9.2%, and that is that it's not that much different than the national average, that for regulated industries, they're hiring a percentage that's approximate to the reality of people. And from my end of it, when it's that different, you want to figure out what is the difference there, and I have no idea.
Could it be training? And maybe it's training, maybe it's inclination. Maybe these people are too smart to want to sit in government cubby holes for the rest of their lives.
That could be part of it, and maybe they are in other industries or other jobs in disproportionate numbers. Just like the airport situation, but it could be anywhere.
Well, if those people are all Sikhs, then obviously there's someplace else where there aren't as many Sikhs and more of somebody else.
That's right, and I would be the last person on the face of this planet to suggest that because there are too many Sikhs in the security customs area that we should change that and get in the proper apportionment of white people to be there. I think that would be just as ridiculous.
But fundamentally, it seems like we talk about a pendulum that was sort of out of whack one way, it's come back. Some people say it's gone too far the other way and have a lot of frustration about that. And the question is, how do you get it to stop at rest in the middle?
But you don't, the people on the left, with all due respect, don't want it to stop. You're not talking about stop. You're still pushing the sucker.
Well, that's the question, is has it gone too far, or has it gone far enough, or should it stop? We say it hasn't gone far enough yet because the stats all show us that we're still way skewed from...
What would happen? Let's say that...
if we didn't have statistics? Why? Let's just burn all these statistics and pretend they don't exist and keep ourselves in total ignorance of that and deal with individuals on an individual basis, assuming that every individual is the smallest minority unit in any given country. And that's why we have something called individual rights, which is the only thing that can make everyone equal.
Well, so, I think that you and I would agree that one day, hopefully, we can do that. The problem is that in the past, if we didn't have statistics, then, we were basically presumably trying to hide the fact that you can't get a job at all if you're black,
What would happen if we found that we continue these policies and 10 years from now, the next census or whenever it's due comes out and says that, boy, we're right on the money. We're exactly where we ought to be. Everybody clap, pat yourself on the back. We do another one 10 years later, and we find that we're back to where we are now. At that point, should we reinstitute a program like that, or should we say, well, maybe it's just sought its natural level, and that's where it is?
Well, and I would agree with you, if 10 years from now we're at the average, then you shut her down. You say, we're where we want to be.
You can't.
But if we fall off the wagon again, then we got to get doing something again.
But how do you know you've fallen off the wagon? Well, how do you know it isn't?
Unfortunately, you got to have statistics.
We've got to pause for a moment here, because the statistics tell us it's time, and we'll be right back. Morning, you can listen to and talk with Jeff Schlimmer and Bob Metz. We would like to remind you, too, if you're a regular listener to this part of the program, we certainly hope you are, and there's a topic that you would like to hear explored by our two guests, whether you agree or disagree with one or the other of them. Perhaps you'd just like to know what their thoughts are and how they would develop a discussion on a topic. Don't hesitate to let us know. You can drop us a line at the station, 743 Wellington Road South, or just give me a call any afternoon, and we'll line that up for you. And the guys are certainly interested in discussing any of the topics of the day. Now, we're almost out of time here. Bob, is there any role for this, given that, I accept that you're not happy about the stats, but given that the stats are here and they appear to tell us something, Is there any kind of a positive, proactive role that we should be taking to address this, or do we simply step back and let nature take its course?
Well, I don't think... Boy, that's a loaded question. Taking a positive role is just an individualistic thing that you can do with yourself. The one thing we must avoid is resorting to government force to change statistics. I mean, that's an absurdity. When you get into a situation where the government starts mandating who can have this job based on the color of their skin, you're back to ground zero, where you don't want to be. And what bothers me is too many people see that as the solution. And then if we can't use force, well, my God, there's no answer anywhere in the world. People are just lost.
But if we accept that discrimination may be a fact, are we not better off to discriminate in what I would call a positive manner than in a totally negative manner?
Well, again, to discriminate in a positive manner means hiring. If you're talking about hiring, it means hiring people on merit. That's the positive discrimination.
Well, I was talking in terms of outcome, though. If we're trying to improve racial harmony and so on and so on, or is that just a pie in the sky? We can't get there from here.
Well, quotas certainly will not help improve racial harmony. They are above all possibly one of the greatest causes of racial disharmony. I don't know what one means by racial harmony. If that means having X percentage of one race in a particular work area, I don't see what's harmonious about that. It's simply a statistic. We got to watch ourselves with statistics and percentages. They can be made to say anything anybody wants them to say. They can be skewed, twisted, turned. A percentage turns in on itself several times, like that, like when we started the show, when you said that 3.1% were new hires. Well, we don't know out of what percentage of applicants that mm-hmm. is. That could be 100% of the applicants, mm-hmm. so that really they're shooting at 100%. You can interpret these statistics any way you want. What really bothers me about it is when the government releases these statistics, they do it in such a way so as to stir up trouble in the country, so as to stir up minorities and make them feel that they are not being treated equal, so that they have this political cause that the government can deflect everyone's attention from while the economy goes down the sewer. I mean, it's a whole deflective issue. It's a non-issue. You have a healthy economy, low taxes, a responsive government, you're not going to have any racism problems.
Jeff Schlemmer?
Well, I guess from my end of it, we've got to make sure we're hiring the best people for our tax dollars. And there's no reason that I've ever seen to suggest that if 11.2% of the people are visible minorities, 11.2% of the people of the best people are also visible minorities. So that's what we should be aiming for, and that's what we see reflected in the federally regulated industry, which is effectively private industry. In the private industry, they're hiring about the same number of visible minorities as there are in society, as you would expect. There's obviously something wrong with the federal government. If they're down at 3%, they're way below that. And my assumption from that is we're not hiring the best people. And we got to figure out why. Because I want the best people for my tax dollars.
Hard to argue with the summations of either of these gentlemen, because as both of you said at one time or another, I'm not so sure that you're all that far apart on where you want to get to. It's just getting there that's the problem. And that's what makes this program interesting every Wednesday. It's called Left, Right, and Center with Robert Metz and Jeff Schlemmer, and I'm Jim Chapman. We thank them for being here. We thank you for listening to the program, too. And again, if you've got a topic you'd like to have discussed, you drop us a line and let us know, and we'll get it on the air on Left, Right, and Center. Coming up tomorrow on the next edition of Talk of the Town, it's Thursday. Ms. Dawn is back, and we hope that she's well enough to... We get our special pad for her foot. She's going to come in the studio and join me for nose-to-nose, toe-to-toe, heel-to-heel, whatever she's calling it this week. We'll be taking a look again at an issue that she and I have some questions about, and we invite you to join us for that, too. Plus, open phones, and hey, who knows what else will happen. All coming your way on the next edition of Talk of the Town. In the meantime,